Hello, everyone. I'm Hal Eisner, and I know what you're doing. You're doing the same thing I'm doing. You know what that is? We're breathing. We're breathing the air around us. And I got to tell you, the air quality here in Los Angeles, California, where we are right now, is not so good. And that's what we're going to talk about with some people who are in the business of dealing with our air. Why don't we start with you and let you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Wayne Nastri. I'm the executive officer of the South Coast Air Quality Management District.
Hi, I'm Will Barrett, the Director of Clean Air Advocacy with the American Lung Association in California.
Hello, I'm Philip Fine. I'm the Deputy Executive Officer at the South Coast AQMD.
And so obviously with all these people that deal with our air and with our breathing, we're going to talk about the air that we breathe. And, you know, it's a pretty serious issue, so serious that the American Lung Association every year puts out a report card, and every year, except for one, Los Angeles fails. Why do we fail?
Well, the American Lung Association State of the Air Report, we've put it out for 20 years now. And what we see is that the LA region really has those higher levels of ozone pollution than any other community in the United States. And a lot of that is to do with the transportation sector, emissions from our cars and trucks and the ports and the rail yards, but also the millions and millions of cars on the road, the geography and the climate all playing a part.
There are all kinds of particles in the air. Mm-hmm. Ozone is one kind of particle?
Ozone is a colorless, odorless gas. You can think about it as a corrosive gas that sort of burns your lungs like a sunburn would your skin. And so that mixes in the atmosphere from tailpipes, for example, on hot, sunny days. So it's more of a summertime pollutant. And then particle pollution is more from incomplete combustion of diesel, wood, fireplace, you know, emissions, and more we're seeing the impacts of wildfires generating tremendous amounts of particle
pollution. Well, we know that has a really bad impact on the air, and we know that there are unhealthful days that happen after fires, and we report those and tell people that if you have a respiratory disorder, maybe don't go outside this day because of the condition of the air. But why don't you give us a better idea of this air around us? What's it made up of? Why don't you pick that up? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so the air quality in Southern California has a long history of being poor, going back decades. So the pollutants that we are most worried about are what Bill mentioned were ozone pollution and particulate pollution, and they come from mostly our combustion sources. There are other types of pollutants as well, and these other types of pollutants might affect local communities. If you have direct tailpipe emissions, you might have things like benzene or hexavalent chromium or very toxic compounds that come from our industries, come from our tailpipes, and those have these really local effects. So if you live next to a freeway or you live next to that industrial facility, there are other types of pollutants that we also work very hard to reduce.
Why do you think it is that for years we've failed? And I know you're going to say, but we are making progress. But how are we failing if we're making progress?
Well, we know we're making progress. We measure air quality every day. We have 40 air monitoring stations throughout the four-county area, and we can see huge progress. We've reduced ozone. We've reduced PM by between 50 and 90%. But there's still a long way to go. We still have the worst air quality. We still have the worst ozone pollution. We've made a huge amount of progress on PM pollution. In just 15 years from when the PM 2.5 standards were set.
PM being particle materials.
PM 2.5 stands for particulate matter that's very small, less than what we call 2.5 microns in diameter. One micron is 1/1000th of a millimeter. So they're very small particles. They're invisible. The standards were first set by the federal government in around the year 2000, and in just 15 years, in 2015, we had cut those levels in half. So we are making progress. We measure the progress. The emissions are coming down. The air quality
is
getting better. Because we're still the worst in the country for ozone and among the worst for particulate. But we started at a very high point. So we've made a lot of progress. We still have a long way to go. But compared to the other areas of the country, we still have some of the worst air pollution.
And I would definitely agree with that. I think that the progress we've seen in the 20 years of the State of the Air Report and in those last 15 years on particle pollution has been tremendous. We know that, unfortunately still, though, that there are too many people on too many days breathing unhealthy air. And that can have a wide range of impacts on especially children and seniors, people living with asthma and other respiratory illnesses.
What about pets? Yeah, do we think in terms of pets can be adversely affected by the quality of the air?
Certainly during the wildfires, that has come up more and more, where people are very concerned about their pets' respiratory health because of the major dose of particle pollution they're getting.
Well, we know when we see evacuations, we see that there are special areas set up for pets, for dogs, for cats, for horses. They breathe just like we breathe, right? So, you know, I guess that sometimes we don't necessarily think about them. But we do think about us. And we know that there are people that walk around with masks on their face. And do they need to do that?
Well, you know, a lot of times people will go back to their homes after a fire. And there's a lot of ash in the air. There's a lot of particulate matter in the air. And as you're going through all the ashes looking for prized possessions, those masks, if they're worn right and if they're fitted right, they're actually very helpful. The challenge comes, a lot of people wear those masks, they're not fitted properly, and they're really not that effective.
All right, so let's talk about that for a second, because we'll use those when we're out covering fires. And we'll wear goggles and we'll wear masks because we want to be protected as we can, as best we can. And some of them do pinch up in the upper part of the nose, and that causes for a sealing of the mask. And so you want to make sure it fits firmly right against your face?
That's right. And those masks that pinch, generally those are the N95 masks, and they can be effective. But as I said before, it's hard to talk with that mask on. So a lot of times you'll see newscasters pull the mask aside so they can be heard a little better.
Well, and for the minute or so that we're on TV, whatever it might happen to be, sometimes we'll drop it to our chin.
Yes.
Just because it's easier for us to talk.
Right.
But I think it's the long exposure, not the short exposure, that would be more of an issue, right?
You're absolutely right. It's the long-term exposure that you're looking at. And the thing that we want to make sure is that people are wearing it right, that it doesn't just simply have them think that they're protected completely.
There are countries like Japan where people wear them all the time. Is it because their pollution is much worse than our pollution, or what is the? It seems like a cultural thing to me, but I mean,
it's more for illness issue for bacteria for things like that. So as you know, most people, if you look at people, they put their hands near their mouth. A lot of people will do this, put it on their face. The mask prevents that barrier from getting into your mouth or.
So that's the reason we tend to see that in some other countries.
In some of the other countries, that's more primarily.
That's interesting.
But you are right that the pollution in places like Beijing and China and other big Chinese cities, or India, Iran, and other places of the world are much worse and have a lot further to go than we have already come in Los Angeles.
Is part of our problem the geography? I mean, okay, so we have the ocean. The ocean gives us a nice marine layer, and we get a nice breeze off of the ocean. You'd think that would sort of kick this stuff out, but then we have these valleys, and the valleys act like soup bowls, right? And so this stuff just settles down. It doesn't rise like heat rises necessarily. It settles into the soup bowls?
Well, what happens is you get a lot of the pollution formation, and what happens is that pollutant then is transported into the Inland Empire. And so in the summertime when you have the inversions, the pollution is trapped, and that's when we'll have the really bad air days.
Well, you see that in the San Fernando Valley, too.
Sure.
And again, that's all part of the geography of the valley, right? Kind of a bowl.
Yeah, I mean, we have the reason our air quality is such a challenge is we have a lot of population. We have a huge amount of goods movement industry. All those ships coming in and all those containers coming off the ships, and driving in the trucks and the trains throughout our area. We have unfortunate geography. We do have that bowl, so the pollution does get trapped. And we have warm, hot weather, which helps to cook those pollutants in the air. So that combination has been a problem for a long, long time. And all we can do about it is really just try to reduce emissions as much as we can.
So you say there's been progress.
There's been a huge amount of progress.
And so what has been the biggest impact to cause that?
I would say technology. Technology has been the key to the reduction of the key pollutants. So for us, it's oxides of nitrogen, whether it's the pollution controls on cars, on trucks, on locomotives, even things that they're doing on ocean-going ships. All of those things have reduced the amount of hazardous emissions.
And yet I heard earlier that trains, and we have a lot of trains here in Southern California, still put out dirt into the air?
Yeah, they put out fine particles into the air, and they also put out oxides of nitrogen, which form particles in the air. They also form ozone in the air. So trains are one of our major sources Right today, trucks are our number one source, but looking forward, as the trucks are starting to clean up, ships and trains are becoming some of our largest sources.
So go ahead, Will.
Well, I would just add, too, that the technology is incredibly important, and the underlying policy, the Clean Air Act, has given us 50 years of progress on cleaning up the air. And one of the things that we point out in our report this year is that all of that amazing progress we're seeing in California and the local regions like L.A., that's at risk because some of those policies are being threatened at the federal level. So we're seeing potential rollbacks of the Clean Power Plan, oil and gas regulations, and for California especially, the Clean Cars standards. So along with that is California's authority to set stronger than national standards that other states can then adopt. So the federal government's plan right now is to say that California should not have that authority and the other states should not have that authority. So it's really removing tools from the Clean Air Toolbox that have proven tremendously effective.
So one of the things that, you know, everybody will say, the Metrolink and probably you guys as well, is that we need to get the cars off the road. Okay, the trucks are the biggest violators, but the cars need to come off the road. But the mass transit system isn't sophisticated enough yet to get from point A to point B without having to switch here and switch there and do this and do that. And for a lot of people, I think that's where the problem is, that a lot of people feel that if it were coming closer to my house, like in New York or Boston or Baltimore, then I'd be more likely to want to take mass transit.
So I think one important thing to note is that while California's made a tremendous amount of progress in cleaning up climate pollution, for example, all of the sectors in the state have cleaned up pollution to meet our 2020 climate targets. But the transportation sector, especially the passenger vehicle sector, has actually seen an increase in carbon pollution because the way our communities are designed, the way that our transit investments have gone, have really not kept up to cut that pollution. So we're seeing this real urgent problem of transportation carbon pollution going up while all their sectors are going down. And what that means is, yes, we need more transit, more zero-emission technology, and, you know, land use decisions that remove us from this cycle of sprawl into healthier communities where people have a lot of different options to get around.
Let me just ask you real quick, on the Lung Association side, you deal with all these various lung disorders, and many of them triggered by the air we breathe. Are you seeing a decrease in the number of patient cases? Are you seeing an increase? Is it status quo?
Well, depending on the type of illness, there are different rates. What we know is that right now there are somewhere around 1.4 million people in the L.A. region living with asthma, and thousands of people are diagnosed every year with lung cancer. And these can all have direct impacts on or from the air we breathe, and those conditions can be made worse when the air gets to be unhealthy. So when we're looking at vulnerable populations, we know that the air is triggering negative health outcomes, but we also know that all of the progress we make is going to make breathing that much easier for our most vulnerable populations, including those with respiratory illnesses, as well as people living by those major trade routes, the ports, the warehouses going in the Inland Empire, where they're seeing thousands and thousands of additional diesel truck trips per day. So this is all kind of to say that we really need to address these issues, and I think that's where the air district's work is so important.
You know, I'm going to have you talk, but we depend on the AQMD to tell us how this air is. You test at how many different sites? 40 sites, I think he said.
Well, we have 40 federal sites that we monitor, right, and report on. Yes, absolutely.
So what goes on at the AQMD? Tell me. I'm just curious. What kind of work goes on there? I know that I can hear that you get a lot of data. I can tell that you have various metering sites. What's going on there to make things better?
Well, at the South Coast Air Quality Management District, we do a lot of different things, and it ranges from technology development. So one of the key things, though, that I think that we do is we actually inventory. We know what all of the emission sources are, and if we don't have a good understanding, then we'll go and collect that type of data. So we know, for instance, what are the emissions from ships? What are the emissions from locomotives? What are the emissions from heavy-duty trucks, from refineries, from power plants, from dry cleaners, auto spray booths, all sorts of things that we collect that information, and we can understand what the formation is. But I really want to address one of the key things when we talk about the pollution, right? we've got to understand how do we stop that pollution. One is we can stop it at the source, and that's where we talk about zero emission technology. And it's important to understand that when we're looking at all those sources, it's the goods movement sector that is really giving us the challenge, because that is the highest emitting sources. So while transit, while people driving in their cars is important, it's important for a different reason, because really that gets to carbon, like what Will was saying, and climate. Air quality, though, is very different, but it's related to climate. And by reducing carbon, we get both. We get the climate benefits and we get the air quality benefits. So what we're doing is we're trying to develop technology that gives us both. It reduces air pollution, it reduces carbon impacts into the environment, and it gets us to meet those cleaner standards that have been set by the federal government.
And the federal government, if we don't meet certain standards, not all of them, but certain standards by 2023, will sanction us financially, right?
Well, they certainly have that ability. And I think if you look at the administration, the way it's been treating California, we are not confident that there's going to be some type of lag or some type of leeway for us to continue our work. We think very strongly that the federal government will come in and really try to impose those sanctions very quickly.
You think so? And that would be in 2023, January 1, or what?
Well, we have to submit plans, and we've got to let EPA react to those plans. But EPA has only a certain amount of latitude, because they can be sued to take action more quickly. So from our perspective, we could anticipate action anywhere from, I would say, 2020, when we have to submit a contingency plan, all the way through 2023.
So this is kind of knocking at your door.
It's a huge challenge, and these deadlines are fast approaching. So even this year, we owe EPA an accounting of how we're going to attain this short-term standard by 2023. And to be honest, that's our most challenging standard. We have to reduce emissions by about 45% in just the next 4 years to be able to meet that standard.
That's a crazy number. I don't know how you get to 45% reduction without 45% of the cars and trucks getting off of the road.
Well, it's through incentives, because we can't regulate fast enough. And we can use incentives. In fact, we've been using incentives for a long time, and they work.
Like what?
So, for instance, we have programs from the state that's, for instance, called the Carl Moyer Program. And it gives
Carl Moyer?
Carl Moyer. He was a scientist, and he was credited with a lot of the work that went into identifying emissions. And one of the things that we had been able to do is to develop a fund. The state developed a fund after him. And we've had hundreds of millions of dollars, and we've been able to replace out old, dirty diesel engines to cleaner engines, to natural gas engines, 90% cleaner. And one of the things that we're talking about when we talk about technology is the development of zero emission. So you have people like Elon Musk at Tesla saying, we're going to have zero emission heavy duty trucks. You've got now Volvo and Daimler saying, we're going to do heavy duty trucks that are all electric. So we're seeing the shift from the diesel engine to a zero emission electric engine that'll reduce the emissions and get us where we need to be.
I suspect one of the issues with the development of that has been the distance in which a vehicle can travel, because we're so widespread, where we're so spread out all over the place, that if your vehicle only does 70 miles on a plug-in, that's probably not going to be enough to do the trick, right? So is one of the things that you guys have been doing is working with these vehicle companies to try to get – I know there are vehicles now like the Bolt, I guess, that can do 200 and whatever, 240 miles. Yeah. But I mean, are you working with these automobile companies?
Yeah. Mostly we're working with the truck companies right now. Automobiles have arrived. The zero-emission automobile has arrived. I drive a battery electric. My wife drives a fuel cell. They work. They have range comparable to other cars. And in the next couple of years, the amount of choices the consumers are going to have on these cars and the incentives available are pretty huge. So we want to develop the newer technology. So the frontier right now is in the heavy-duty truck sector. There are electric trucks that can go, 50, 100 miles, but that's not enough for a lot of the duty cycles in our areas. So, again, companies like Tesla and Daimler are looking at 200, 300, 400 miles for these trucks. They're not there yet, but we need to do everything we can to encourage that development.
And then there's the infrastructure where you have to put stations where you can plug in your car. And what do you need for a fuel cell? I'm not even sure what you need for a fuel cell.
Hydrogen.
So yeah, I know there was one station down the street from here that had a hydrogen. It was a fuel cell station. And I don't know that they still have it because I don't know that there were enough cars to really do anything with it.
Well, you actually have a number of hydrogen stations throughout the state. I think the number that I last heard is about 40. And
in all of California?
In all of California.
That doesn't sound like very many.
Well, they're having
there are 40 gas stations on my corner.
Yeah, they're trying to build that up.
And I think that, just to interrupt, they're really trying to be strategic about building out this new infrastructure. It's a brand new world of getting people into these hydrogen cars. And really being strategic about where those infrastructure needs are now and where they're going to grow. So I know that the state is doing a lot of work on identifying where to best site these. Right now, you can drive up and down the state through in a hydrogen car. You can drive from the Bay Area to Lake Tahoe in a hydrogen car. The corridors are developing, but it is that planning stage right now.
I remember Governor Schwarzenegger. One of the big issues for him was trying to create an infrastructure. I guess that went all right. I don't know.
The hydrogen highway concept, originated with Governor Schwarzenegger.
And where are we on that?
So we're moving forward. The state has a goal to have, I believe, over 100 hydrogen fuel stations in place in the very near future. As I said, we're 40, probably 40 plus into that. They are very strategic where they're located. There's one at our facility in Diamond Bar that we know is constantly being used. I think the highest.
Can anybody come by your office?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's actually a new one opening in Sacramento tomorrow, and they're, again, just trying to be very strategic about where they're going. And I do think on the heavy-duty electric side, that's where, again, strategically looking at those duty cycles that fit right now and can do the job and making sure that we're investing in those as we're, like you said, developing the technology for the longer haul.
This is really a fascinating conversation for me because I think that I've watched the development of this over years. We've gone from, a period where we were really stuck on fossil fuels and did our public policy was all about using gasoline. And now it seems that we've made a turn on that. And there are more of these vehicles coming out, better options like hybrids, and hydrogen fuel and electric cars. And it seems like some of them get more mileage now. So it sounds like this is a force that's moving forward. Is that right? Is that your sense of it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're not there yet. Obviously, there's not enough electric cars or hydrogen cars on the road, but the cost is becoming competitive. The performance, anyone who's drove one says the performance is equal or better.
But the cost is an issue for some people. They can't afford to do that. And you can tell them that they won't spend money on gasoline. But gasoline, when you go to the pump, is a bill every month for a couple of fill-ups. So it's not like a big front-end investment.
But there still are incentives available through the federal government, through the state. There's a developing used car market that is just emerging now because these cars are already becoming 3 or 4 years old where people can get them less expensively, and there are incentives available even on the used cars car market. And we are seeing the prices come down. And it's not just the U.S. manufacturers. I mean, electric vehicles are being produced all over the world, especially in China. They're not being sold here for whatever reason, but there's 8 or 9 electric car manufacturers doing huge volumes in China.
And many of the automakers have put forward their plans to go full electric lines of their vehicles. But there's also these incentives that utilities offer, some local governments and air districts.
I just recently read that Audi was planning on doing all electric. But whether they are or they're not, that seems to be the future. And so how long have you been with AQMD?
I've been there about 13 years.
And over that 13-year period, if you were to try to size it up, what's happened? How have we improved over 13 years?
We do measure air quality. We know the air quality has improved. As an agency, we've become much more proactive in several areas. As a local area agency, our primary responsibility is stationary sources. So the regulations that we pass locally are looking at gas stations and refineries and any other type of industrial facility. So we've continued to pass these rules, some of the strictest rules in the nation for the stationary sources. But one of the biggest developments is over the last, I'd say, 13 years, it's environmental justice. So these are those communities, the disadvantaged communities, low-income communities that are located you know, next to that refinery or next to that freeway, and they're affected by this regional pollution we've been talking about, but they're also affected by those localized sources that they only live a block from or half a block from. So our focus has shifted to addressing those air quality problems in those communities. Some of the solutions are the same. The zero emission vehicle helps that community and helps the regional air quality. But we've really started to focus on those communities. There was a bill passed 2 years ago signed by the governor that it was AB 617 that really kind of changed the way we look at these communities and where we put our efforts in terms of reducing exposure.
One of the things being talked about now that seems to be getting some traction is congestion fees. And basically what that is, if I understand it correctly, it's turning a freeway into a toll road during certain hours of the day when it would be mostly congested. So you might have to pay $4 to ride on that freeway or more or less or whatever it's determined to be. A lot of people would look at that as, well, wait a minute. I'm already paying for the roads. I'm already paying taxes. Why do I have to now pay a fee to ride on the road I've already paid for? And yet this is an idea that actually is gaining traction. What do you guys say to that? Any thoughts?
Well, again, we're not a transportation agency, and I know you've done some recent shows for that. So, you know, there is.
But does that help the air?
Well, what we hope would happen is if there are fees for using certain roadways, that there could be discounts if you have zero emission vehicles, or maybe it's free, just like you get the DMV stickers if you have that zero emission vehicle. So, if they are going to charge, and we recognize the need for revenue to keep our roads in good condition, one way to incentivize the cleaner vehicles is to have a discount if you do have those cleaner vehicles.
And this is something that you guys have been talking to your partner agencies about, I assume?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when we look at that, we talk about an incentive for clean technology. We also have incentive programs that directly benefit the average resident, the consumer. So we have a Replace Your Ride program where members of disadvantaged communities can bring in their old car. Generally, those cars are higher polluting, trade it in, and walk away oftentimes with no cash with a used electric vehicle.
I live in a disadvantaged community. Oh, what the hell? Okay, I don't. But you know, how do you determine who's in a disadvantaged community?
Well, you look at income, you look at a lot of different data that has to be provided, and the intent here is to make sure that the technology is available to everyone.
So you give grants?
We do.
Basically grants.
That's right. And those grants then incentivize the deployment of technology throughout the different ranges, right? And then that makes it even more popular, more people can see it and see that that's a very viable alternative.
What's your biggest worry at the American Lung Association?
Well, I think our biggest worry is that our progress stalls, that our policies are not able to move forward because they've been proven so effective. And I think as part of what the gentlemen have been talking about, this real focus on cleaning up the air, especially in our most impacted communities, places that have been oftentimes overlooked. These are lower-income communities, often communities of color, where the benefits of these new technologies haven't always been present. And so the renewed focus and the really critical focus there that we are investing in cleaning up the air for everybody and nobody gets left behind as we're addressing our air pollution and climate challenges.
You deal with clean air and being a coordinator of information to the public for that?
That's right.
And so what do you do to put information out there to the public besides come on shows like this?
Well, sure. This is a big part of it, and we thank you. And especially this week is Women's Lung Health Week across the United States. It's really raising awareness about lung cancer. So that's one of our many policies that are projects that we do to really raise awareness of the issues related to lung health, air pollution, and other things that are affecting public health, because we know that the more the public hears the message that there are solutions out there, that we're making progress, that all of our clean air partners are working as hard as possible to clean it up. But we still have a way to go. And we also know that with the impacts of climate change, we're really trying to use the message that climate change is making the job of cleaning up the air that much more difficult.
Climate change is probably a very big part of this conversation, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let me hear what the AQMD thinks about climate change.
Well, one of the challenges we have, we talked about the amount of emission reductions we need to meet to achieve healthy air, to meet the federal standards. But what we've seen in recent years is we've had warmer summers. We've had the drought years, not this last year, but in previous years. So when it's a warmer summer, you get higher ozone. When it's when you get less rain in the winter, you get higher particulate matter. So the last few years have shown we've had a little bit of a backsliding in our air quality because of those conditions. Now, we don't know for sure whether that is due to climate change, but if those conditions continue or get worse, they're probably consistent with some of the climate change projections. That would mean we have to reduce emissions even more than what we already
have. And it's already tough to do it.
And it's already tough.
Helen, if I could just add to that, you know, recently the U.S. government came out with the fourth national climate assessment. And so as Phil talked about the recent increases that we've seen in pollutants, that's true across the entire western United States. So it's not just us. And that's where we think that you can see the impacts of climate change. And as Phil had said, it makes it much more difficult for us to meet those standards. So that's why it's more important than ever that we look at this in a combined effort, both climate and air quality. And it's going to take a partnership. We all breathe, we all drive, we all utilize goods.
I'm breathing right now.
We got to do something about it. Right?
We all breathe, and we're kind of in a position where we have to breathe whatever the air is around us.
And I would just point out that the Lung Association's 2019 report covers air pollution data from 2015, 2016, and 2017. Those are the three hottest years on record, and we had seven of the 20 most destructive wildfires in state history during that three-year period. Those are the fingerprints of climate change on our air pollution, our air quality. And that's what as Wayne was saying, we've seen this across the West. We've seen the impact of wildfires across the West driving up particle pollution. But we've also seen nationally the impacts of ozone pollution due to these higher temperatures during that three-year period. And we know that our report doesn't capture the 2018 wildfires that devastated so much of Northern California. So we know that this is a growing threat. We know there's an urgency to it. And as Wayne noted, there have been a string of really high-impact climate reports over the last 6 months showing just how urgent the issue is and how much time or lack of time we have to really address the problem.
I would tell you, as a guy who's been reporting in the middle of these fires, the Thomas fire was extraordinary in not a good way. And the Woolsey fire, same thing. And I'll tell you, for a guy who's covered fires for decades, they do seem worse to me. Well, and I don't think there's any denying it.
And this year in the State of the Air report was the first time we ever had a situation where there wasn't a single A given out for particle pollution days.
Nobody got an A.
Nobody got an A. And last year we had Ventura County, Santa Barbara County, both with A's, dropping to F's because of those fires that you mentioned. It's a really clear message that these massive events, these climate-driven events, are having a real real negative impact on local health and air quality.
All right. I want to give you all a chance to sort of give us a final thought. Tell us about the apps you have that people might be able to participate in, and maybe a tip, maybe a piece of advice. And I don't guess a good piece of advice would be get out of your car and go buy an electric, although that would probably be something you'd like to see. But what kind of advice would you offer? So apps, advice, and final thoughts.
I'll stick with the app. So we have our South Coast Air Quality Management District has an app. You can download it, Apple, and it's about to come out for Android. I think it's in beta version. Just search SCAQMD, download it, and it provides a lot of information. But most importantly, you can see what your air quality is in real time, where you are right then. So if you're thinking of exercising or thinking of going outdoors, you can make some decisions based on that local air quality where you are.
I think that's really an interesting use of technology. I mean, it's always been you had to hear it on radio or see it on television, and you wouldn't have it in your hand, and now you've got it in your hand. So I think that's a really interesting advance. Go ahead, Will.
Well, as far as a piece of advice, I would say that if you have any concern about the air you breathe, you need to speak out about it. You have to let your local elected officials know. You have to let your local planners know, your state representatives know, and the federal government needs to hear. Air quality is a clean air is a right that everybody has. And if you have any interest in making sure that we're improving and continuing the progress that we've been discussing here today, you need to speak out. One way that I think that people can do that is tell their story. We know that people have significant health impacts that are directly impacted by local air pollution, and they can tell that story and be very effective messengers for the fight for clean air.
Do you have a place on your website for that?
Yeah, I would suggest that people look at www.lung.org.
Lung.org.
Lung.org/SOTA, and you can find ways to tell your story, connect with us, and really help to move the ball forward.
All right. Wayne?
I would say that if you want to learn more about our organization, you can follow us on social media at South Coast AQMD. You can also go to our website, aqmd.gov. And I guess the tip that I would ask is, as Will talked about, understanding the partnerships and the people that you need to reach out to, think about the goods that you do, think about the things that you do, and think about the businesses that bring them to you. Because we as consumers can impact the choices that those suppliers make, and we want to make sure that they're providing us products in the cleanest way and most environmentally friendly way.
Okay, so let me just pick up on that. So we've seen an increase in delivery services. I'm not going to name them, but you know, this one will give you food, and this one will give you groceries, and this one will go. All of a sudden, everybody's in the delivery service. That doesn't help you, does it?
Well, if they're an electric vehicle delivery vehicle, then that's okay. Well,
I would say that of all the ones that I've had, I haven't seen a single electric vehicle.
And that's where you as a consumer can say, why aren't you giving me these kind of products in a way that makes our environment safe and makes the air that I breathe better?
Okay. So go ahead, Will.
I would just add that we also have our voices can be very effective in talking about to those same industries that as you're putting in a giant warehouse in the Inland Empire, let's make sure it's as clean as can possibly be, make sure that it's being served by the cleanest trucks possible, and making sure that it's relying on the cleanest operations on site, because we know that there are tens of thousands potentially of new truck trips every day coming into those communities that already have some of the most polluted air in the country. So every piece of consumer electronics that goes through those big warehouses is really being subsidized by the lungs of the people who live in those neighborhoods.
So everything you guys are doing is to make it easier for us to breathe or to breathe easier.
Absolutely.
And that is the goal. But I'm going to ask you a real tough question here to end. How long do you think it's going to take before we have clean air?
Well, we've got till 2023 and 2031 to meet those standards.
And what's the 2031 deadline?
That's the 8-hour ozone for 75 ppb.
Which means?
It's just the standards get tougher and tougher.
As time goes on.
As time
we
goes
have
on.
New deadlines and tighter standards. So we still have about 5 or 6 of them in the future we're working towards.
So instead of one door, it looks like you got a whole hallway of doors.
Yes. And those doors are basically set based on the best science available showing how health protective our air, our standards need to be. And that's one of the areas where we know that we need our federal government to stand up and do the right thing.
And so the work will go on to try to make our air cleaner and better. But, of course, it's important, as everybody has pointed out, if you think you have a respiratory concern, check with your doctor. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.